The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, does the Bible command us to forgive everybody, even ruthless dictators with concentration camps? Well, if they actually repent, certainly. Look, Donald Trump is very good at eventually making peace with his adversaries, and it's fine, I guess, that he's meeting with Kim Jong-un, but the North Korea dictator is still a ruthless murderer, so I sure hope we don't get a tweet from the president telling us what a great guy he is. You know, I'm sat down, I'm at him, he's really a great guy. Well, I will now introduce you to a genuine great guy, contributor for National Review, Mike Friedenberg. Mike, welcome back to our program.
Well, Bob, thanks for having me back on again. Quite an honor to be here. And, you know, North Korea is a relevant topic. It's an important topic, and it's even an urgent topic. So it's both urgent and important. You know, what you just said in your opening there, I certainly agree with you. I hope that our president is not tweeting about, you know, after meeting with Kim Jong-un, what a wonderful guy he is. he won't really mean it if he says
if it. If he wants to say, I appreciate that he was willing to sit down and talk to me, that's about it. And frankly, I'm not really letting out a big sigh of relief unless they allowed us to not only inspect, but go beyond that and personally dismantle the weapons ourselves, which I don't believe is going to happen. I'm not sure how different this is. I know Trump's been negotiating from a position of strength, unlike some of the cowering people that we've had in our past, some of those nutcase presidents of the past. But still, I'm not sure I see that much of a difference.
Well, those nutcases included both Bush presidents.
I know.
George H.W.
I was not a big fan of the way Bush.
And
I mean, he called it part of the axis of evil, but then he really didn't do anything about it.
And
then Bill Clinton paid Obama $5 billion to get him to stop building bombs, and they used the money to build bombs. That was money well spent.
No. So Trump was handed a horrible, horrible situation. Yeah. And what I will say is that when I first heard that President Trump, you know, would be willing to meet with Kim Jong-un, my first thought was, this is a mistake. What a bad idea. But after thinking about it a bit, you know, here's how I think it actually could be a good idea. The first thing you noticed is we're not talking about 6 months down the road to get together to meet. We're talking about in May. Now, that's what they're shooting for. So May, and there's a lot of logistics to do on this. So that's a very quick turnaround for something like this. And what I believe is happening is that what we've seen is President Trump go through all the steps he needs to do to show that he is leaving no stone unturned to avoid military action. None whatsoever.
But you believe eventually we're going to have military
action? We'll see. So, but here's what this accomplished. First of all, you saw how he worked with China. Now, when Trump ran, one of the things that appealed to me about his candidacy was his tough talk on China. Because I personally believe that China, that we've been trade dupes, trade patsies, that China has been taking us to the cleaners for 20 years, and they don't believe in the market. They're not a market economy. They don't believe in the free market. So when I hear people defending China on the basis of the market, it just drives me crazy. They have no respect for the free market. They have no respect for free trade.
And yet Trump has complimented China a few times since he's been elected.
So when he came into office, he had a decision to make. Was he going to move forward rapidly to implement, you know,
measures to get China to back off its mercantilist trade policies, its predatory trade practices? Or was he going to try to use the threat of that, and there's, believe me, there's the threat there, to get China to go along with him to implement trade and to implement sanctions on North Korea? And he had that club, the trade club, that he was able to use China, used to, against China, to get China to implement some very strict sanctions. Now, they've been cheating a bit. In fact, they definitely have been cheating.
No.
Yes, they have been, particularly in the area of fuel. We've caught a couple of their, you know, tankers, you know, taking fuel into North Korea. But they have done more on sanctions than has ever been done before, far more than anybody else would have thought possible. So he had to make a decision, you know, getting, you know, so holding China accountable on trade or seeing if he could get them to help and solve the North Korea problem. So he's done that. Now, with this business of being willing to meet with Kim Jong-un, a very rapid meeting with Kim Jong-un with conditions, basically saying, okay, when we're done with this, we have to have clear-cut, very immediate things happening. For example, we have to have U.S. and international inspectors. We're not just going to tolerate international inspectors. U.S. and international inspectors.
I don't trust the international inspectors any farther than I can.
That's why I say we have to have U.S. inspectors and international inspectors.
I think we should have only U.S. inspectors.
Well, we'll see. But as long as we get U.S. inspectors in there to validate, right, that we could live with that. And you may have to do that.
Will that validation be reliable, though? I mean, couldn't they just have secret weapons that they're still not showing us?
I'm going to assume that we have some people that have studied China, not China, but North Korea, day in and day out.
So you think they have the kind of intelligence?
Yes,
where
they have a pretty good idea where the facilities are. They may not know exactly where they are in terms of targeting a strike, but they know where the activity's taking place. They have satellite imagery.
Maybe
they know
I should
this
just
kind of
interview
stuff.
Dennis Rodman. Didn't he get the grand tour?
Yes.
He probably knows exactly
where they are. And of course, they will take in Dennis Rodman's information and give it all the credit that it
deserves. I
think
Dennis Rodman talked about what a great guy he was.
Yes, exactly. So they established that. Now, if they're not willing to, I mean, immediately open up for inspections, U.S. and international, but U.S. has got to be part of it. International is not just acceptable. U.S. international inspections, if they're not willing to do that, Trump walks out of there, right? And as he is haircut, wherever the meeting is, let's say it's a helicopter. As this helicopter is flying back over into South Korea, overhead at a high altitude will be F-22s and other airplanes flying in to begin to destroy the command and control structures and start to take out the nuclear sites. Because at that point, I do believe that there is no way that Kim Jong-un is going to give up these weapons without
I don't think he plans to give them up. And I say no partial reductions, no prolonged schedules of when we can inspect, just everything on the table right now.
I don't think
we should settle for one inch less than that.
Of course not, because right now, if we could have possibly looked at something like that 10 years ago, but right now we're talking a matter. Some people say maybe up to a year, but we're right there on the cusp. Kim Jong-un's right on the cusp of getting deliverable nuclear weapons. That means ICBMs capable of reaching our allies and the United States. So we don't have time to dink around anymore.
And we've got to find out what they've already given or sold to Iran also.
Well, and that's right. As a nuclear power, they would also could be enablers of Iran's nuclear ambitions as well. So there's a lot at risk here. And here's another thing that's at risk is Kim Jong-un and his father have had a history of launching random attacks into South Korea, killing civilians, killing military people, under the threat that, do you really want to start a conventional war when I have all this artillery? We'll talk about that in a second. The artillery poised along the North Korean side of the DMZ. Do you really want to start a fight? So just imagine, though, if he had nuclear weapons, deliverable nuclear weapons to back him up, what kind of things he'd be willing to do, saying, hey, what are you going to do? I mean, he has been willing to kill people just to make a point and to keep people back on their
heels.
And
that's why we've got to be willing to kill in self-defense.
So now the reason we have not done so and
it's because we've had spineless wuss jellyfish presidents.
That's part of it, but I think that a reasonable person could have some concern about going into war with North Korea. I mean, they've got 3-4 million people under arms. They have another 5 million they can bring
and
up.
They could kill a lot of people from South Korea.
They do.
I think a reasonable person could be concerned about that.
A
reasonable person would say, despite my concern, what are the alternatives?
Okay, well, here's an article that appeared in Foreign Policy magazine in 2009. Here's something, here's you know, sort of the side that says, hey, even if they do get nuclear weapons, maybe we just have to live with it. In Foreign Policy magazine, it's a pretty respected magazine. They estimated $1 trillion in property damage, 1 million casualties, and 52,000 military casualties, U.S. military casualties, should the United States and South Korea go to war. I mean,
yeah, but here's the thing. Who's to say that they couldn't do all that anyway, even if we didn't go to war?
Well, right. We don't know what they would do. But basically what I want to talk about is that those kind of analysis and that kind of what I'm going to call hysterical analysis is not fact-based. It's hysterical. In no way are we talking anything like that. In fact, you know, now that's about 9 years later. We're probably closer in some ways to a situation like Iraq than we are to talking about a million casualties. Now, the difference between the Iraqi freedom and what we're talking about here with North Korea is that there is artillery poised along the border, as well as rocket launchers that could strike South Korea. So there is going to be some civilian casualties. But if we actually do a preemptive strike, we go in first, which is the only sane thing to do. Letting him strike first is craziness. If we decide that he is not going to play ball, that he is not going to denuclearize, then we would be going into a first strike. And if we do that, the city of Seoul actually has enough bomb shelters. They have double the number of bomb shelters necessary to shield the entire population.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, that's something we don't hear about very often.
Double them. So, and those bomb, even though South Korea seems somewhat blasé a little bit, some people are concerned about that, they realize that they're who they're next to. Every single major building they made, every single subway, everything was built to bomb shelter specifications. So they have that. So if we do a preemptive strike and we give the civilian population time to get into the subways,
the damage might be minimal.
They've got hundreds and hundreds of miles of subways that would literally would allow them to evacuate south, away from the border, and out of range of the artillery pieces. So preemptive, and most of the analysis we see is just, you know, the city of Seoul sitting there dumbly, you know, going about its business workday, and North Korea opening up with artillery. Now, let's talk about the North Korean artillery. They have about 12,000 pieces, but realistically, only a very small percentage of those are able to actually reach Seoul. And that would be 500 of their big 170-millimeter Coxsen artilleries pieces, 170-millimeter. Those, using rocket-assisted projectiles, can go about 35 to 37 miles. It's about 35 miles from the border to Seoul proper. Then you have the rocket launchers, 240-millimeter rocket launchers, 300-millimeter rocket launchers. They can go all the way into Seoul, not just the north edge of it, all the way into Seoul. And these are the ones that literally could hit Seoul and cause damage. But when we come back, we can discuss why this threat is not nearly as great as some sources have seemed to indicate that it is.
Okay, our guest is Mike Friedenberg, here to tell you that you really can sleep well at night. We'll be right back.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook. Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at wisdomworkschristianpreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. wisdomworkschristianpreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to 1170 The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel, joined today by National Review contributor Mike Friedenberg. Mike, I want to get your response to this comment we've got on Facebook regarding what I said about Donald Trump calling the dictator of North Korea a nice guy. He says, I see this differently, Bob. Mr. Trump can call this porky little nut job anything he wants as long as he takes away the nukes and leaves them with no real power. North Korea's entire national economy is equal to one small U.S. state. They are about to go bankrupt, and the people are sick and starving to death. KJU is desperate and scared stiff. The only way you can get close to a ruthless, murdering, tyrannical, suspicious bully is to show them some respect and appear to be nice to them. Then you can stick the knife in. Once the people of North Korea have an opportunity to see something from the outside like President Trump and the influence of the U.S., it will shake them. UN's own people will kill him. UN's own people, not the UN. I don't think the UN would do anything but write him a letter. UN's own people will kill him sooner or later. The U.S. should make friends now, not enemies. You know, Russ, I don't have a problem with most of what you're saying, and I appreciate the spirit of it, but I still wouldn't want to hear a dictator complimented. What do you think, Mike?
I do agree with most of what Russ said there. But I also will agree with you is that this guy, he's not. There's nothing really ambiguous about him. He is a murderer. He's had his own family members killed, poisoned. He plots attacks against the peaceful South Korean people. He's letting his own people starve to death by the many, many thousands in order to move forward with his nuclear program. So I really could do without Donald Trump saying he's a great guy. I love Donald Trump. But sometimes in the moment, he'll say something, you know, that I mean, I didn't even appreciate him talking about Obama being such a great guy sitting in the Oval Office with him.
Yeah, especially since Obama never really left power and left the deep state in there. Obama's footprints are everywhere.
And I don't really believe that Donald Trump thought he was a great guy either.
No.
He sometimes will say things that sound nice.
Well,
he's
off the cuff. You know, when somebody gets on his good side, he wants to compliment him. When they get on his bad side, he takes out the knife. And I get that to a point. And I'm not one of those people that thinks he needs to speak more presidential. I don't care about sounding presidential, but I don't want to hear a nutcase dictator called a great guy. Don't.
Yes. Now, if that was the alternative, though, he calls Kim Jong-un a great guy, and somehow that leads to the denuclearization of North Korea without us having to lose thousands of troops.
I could live with that.
I will live with that.
I could live with that, but I would still wish he hadn't called him a great guy.
Right, but that's really came down to that. Somehow we could determine that's what it took.
Yeah, well, obviously, if we knew that was going to happen.
That saves one human life, I would actually do it. So, but I agree with you. I don't think it's
going to get... I'd say if it saves two human lives.
Okay, two.
Yeah.
Well, about one and a half, Bob.
Okay. We'll take the moderate position. Yes. One and a half.
Yes. So back to where we're talking about so one of the reasons we have not really considered, seriously considered not, or have not undertaken regime change in, well, there's a couple of reasons, but one of the big reasons is this threat of this artillery poised along the border. Of course, the other threat was the idea that, you know, we have to contend with China on the back end, you know, coming across and coming in through. I think that that threat, let's talk about that briefly. During the Korean War, China had no connections hardly to the West. They were very relatively isolated, not very little dependency on the Western world. Today, if China were to come in on the side of North Korea, they would immediately lose. Their economy would just implode. I mean, we ought to talk about a disaster. They can't do it.
But hasn't China put us on notice that they won't tolerate any kind of airstrike?
Against them, you know what, they can say a lot of things. They can say a lot of things. They can say that, but if they would be devastated by this, okay? They would be devastated. They've got a good thing going right now. They may feel they can outmaneuver Donald Trump on the trade issues, and right now they're in the catbird seat. They've been able to, you know, to fortify the South China Sea. That was allowed, you know, heavily involved. That Obama let them do that. They've been able to expand their influence pretty much everywhere. So things are looking good for China right now. And they're not going to mess it up over North Korea. That's my belief. And a lot of people do believe that as well. It's a completely different situation. They know that they have enough military force to stop the U.S. coming across. They're not concerned about the U.S. going through North Korea and then coming after them. They really seriously aren't.
So, and if they know that, if they decide to help Trump, they know that he might call them great guys. So,
well, yes,
that's to their advantage.
Well,
too.
Trump was complimenting President Xi just yesterday, I believe. So, with that said, I don't think China really. I don't think China.
You don't think they're going to make a big difference?
I do not think that they would automatically get involved in the war if we decided to do a preemptive strike to take out Kim Jong-un.
Probably not. I'm guessing that they would stay out of it. It's a gamble, but I don't think it would happen.
It's a gamble, but it's less of a gamble than it was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, it would have been more likely.
Well, and they know Donald Trump is somebody to contend with. If it was Obama, they might do a military posturing because they knew they could push him around.
And I do believe that's true, too. So with China, let's assume right now that China's staying out of the picture for the time being, okay? And now we're just looking at North Korea, and we're looking at that artillery. The first thing is that they've got, I think it's 160 miles of DMZ they have to defend. So they don't want South Korean and U.S. forces coming around the end and flanking them in an attack. So they've got to distribute all that artillery along the entire border. And the biggest, longest striking artillery is the Coxswain. And the Coxswain, you know, as I said, with normal rounds, it's allegedly able to fire 24 miles, which is extremely long. And with rocket-assisted rounds, it's able to go 37 miles. So that's some of their best artillery. They can't just concentrate it all within range of Seoul because they've got the entire border to protect. Then you start talking about the fact that they have to protect it. So they have hardened artillery sites called HARTs, hardened artillery sites, where they have these guns secured that could, you know, survive attacks from, you know, maybe a bomb or some counter artillery strikes. They've got a limited number of those. So now we're down to maybe 100 Coxswain guns and maybe some of the multiple rocket launchers. And what would happen, you know, as I said, if we do a preemptive strike and people go into shelters, we're going to be talking casualties on the order, if they were to strike civilians, by the way, and they'd have to think twice about it because they opened up on this Seoul, then immediately it becomes regime change. There's no chance of negotiating at that point. There's no chance of pulling back and saying, okay, hey, we'll give you a chance to get rid of the nuclear weapons. If they went after civilians big time with their weaponry, you know, showing that intent at an attack in Seoul, it becomes a pure regime change play. And whether they would do that or not is very questionable. So the bottom line is the artillery is not anywhere near the threat that people think it is. And I am about ready to do an article that will show that's even less than a threat than some of the more sober analysis has shown.
Okay, more of Mike's analysis when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Looking for a book you won't be able to put down? Push the Winds Around is a romance set in the context of science fiction. Dr. Brandon Krieger is given the opportunity of a lifetime, a psychologist's dream. Through the usage of his physics professor friend's time machine, Brandon travels 20 years back through time in an attempt to change one man's destiny. Tom Kyle, a convicted and unremorseful murderer, is located in the past when he was a 6-year-old boy. Brandon's mission? To alter Tom Kyle's path and prevent him from being a vicious killer. Matters are complicated when Brandon finds himself falling in love with young Tom's mother. Push the Winds Around, a novel by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Back to the Bob Siegel Show. Say hello again to National Review contributor Mike Friedenberg.
So just briefly to go back to what Russ was saying, it's quite true that their GDP is pretty amazingly low. The state with the smallest GDP in the United States is Vermont, and North Korea's GDP is actually less than that. With that said, it makes me believe that measuring GDP for a centrally planned economy like North Korea is probably not the most accurate measure of it, because there's no way Vermont could support the size of the military infrastructure that North Korea supports. So, their GDP is not impressive. And that also brings up the point that South Korea's GDP is 50 times that of North Korea. South Korea has more potential people in the military reserves to be brought in to fight. They're twice as big a country, and they have twice the number of reserves that could be brought in.
Do they have a well-trained army?
They have an extremely well-trained army.
How does it compare to North Korea's training?
North Korean men many of them will spend about 10 years in the military. In fact, in order to earn the right to mate, you have to serve in the military.
You're kidding. No. Oh, my gosh.
So, and then women serve about 7 years. So they do spend a lot of time in the military, and you know that's more than, let's say, a typical two-year term there. But they also will be used at times to pick crops and do other things like that. And they run little businesses. The military runs little businesses, try to make money. But that's since Trump put the sanctions in, they're not making any more money. So, but getting back to the point there is the South Korean military is far, far more powerful than the North Korean military. It's not even close. 20, 30 years ago, maybe it was competitive. Now, and I believe that's why we've been hearing a lot more bluster coming out of North Korea, especially from Kim Jong-un, because he knows that maybe paper tigers, a bit of a strong term, but there is an aspect to that. Their military, their population starving. Even their army, the people in the army are malnourished. There's no reserves of food anymore. There's no reserves of fuel. They can probably only fight for a few days before the military shuts down logistically. I mean, they are in bad shape. Their Air Force planes, many of them, I don't know what percentage, but there are many, a high percentage of them cannot even fly. So on paper, They look powerful. They've got 500-600 fighters, about the same number as South Korea, but the fighters are grounded. And then the fighters that do fly, their pilots are getting 20 hours a year in flight, actual flight time, which means they can barely fire those planes. They will not contest the skies against the U.S. and South Korean pilots. So the United States will have complete air superiority. So if they open up with artillery pieces, they have to roll them out of the protective shelter. They have to fire and have to roll them back in. They will be under savage attack by South Korean and U.S. air forces. They will be suffering brutal counterfire from South Korean artillery. And South Korean artillery and U.S. artillery, and we have equipped the South Koreans, and we have our own artillery over there equipped with what's called the Excalibur round. The Excalibur round gives our artillery extraordinary range and the accuracy within 5 meters. So we could fire from 40 kilometers out and hit within 5 meters, which means that we have a huge advantage in an artillery duel. If they fire, we can track where that shell came down to within meters and blast their stuff out of existence. Then we'll have the South Korean troops and U.S. troops. And if they start killing South Korean civilians, they're coming for that artillery, I mean, fast. That 35 miles is going to disappear.
You're giving us a very optimistic perspective that I don't think a lot of people hear. So this is good stuff.
I think what's dominated the media, if you do a Google search, you're going to find an appeasement-oriented search returns that are basically designed to scare the American public into saying we can't do anything military.
And there have been a few people from the mainstream media this week, which grudgingly, I didn't think I'd live to see the day, complimented Trump. But I think they're only complimenting because they view him as doing appeasement. In other words, they're saying, oh, he's finally doing what we always wanted to do. And that's not really what Trump's doing. No. He's negotiating from a position of strength.
Something that has driven me batty is I've been listening to these people, I guess, sort of complimenting Trump, saying, well, now he's using diplomacy. Before, he was just blustering and rattling the saber and make, you know what, Bob, that was part of this diplomacy.
Exactly.
Give me a break.
It's wiser diplomacy.
A realpolitik view of diplomacy includes military force. So the idea that this is part.
It's the speak softly, carry a big stick.
Without the sanctions, without the rhetoric, we would not have Kim Jong-un here because he actually is afraid that we are considering military options and he's trying to delay those by negotiating and doing long, drawn-out negotiations. Now, I don't believe that Trump will tolerate that. President Trump will tolerate that. But I do think it's worthwhile for him to go there and to basically say, I've done everything. We clearly saw that Kim Jong-un was not willing to really be serious about nuclear disarmament. So if he does that and he comes back and then we initiate preemptive military strikes against North Korea, we can... Listen, there's going to be casualties. There will be civilian casualties. There will be civilian casualties in South Korea.
But nothing like what we would see if we just sat around and waited for them to nuke Hawaii or Japan.
And I'm not even necessarily sure when that would happen. But what would...
Well, within a couple of years, they would have that
technology. They'd have nuclear weapons, but would he use them? I don't think he would right away. What I think he would do is I would think he would use the threat of nuclear weapons to be able to use conventional weapons to attack. And with impunity saying, okay, I'm attacking conventional weapons, I'm doing this, but if somebody comes after me, I will protect myself with nuclear weapons. Yeah. That's, I think, is the more likely scenario.
Well, maybe Trump can offer him, hey, if you're willing to step down as dictator, I'll give you a permanent gig on one of my reality shows. Maybe the guy's ego will go for that carrot instead.
Well, he does have an ego, and that's but Kim Jong-un believes he needs nuclear weapons to survive. Yeah. He's probably right about that.
Okay, we'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel. As a Christian apologist, I hear scorning and ridicule all the time from Bible skeptics and unbelievers. Some churches will still respond to such people with love and understanding. Others do not.
You Christians are such morons. There's no proof that God exists, and only a pea brain would believe in miracles. Wake up! Step into the 21st century. Besides, Christianity is responsible for most of the world's problems.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Relax, my friends. That's not the kind of response you'll get from Skyline Church. We welcome you just as you are, with all your doubts, all your questions, and all your concerns. Your problems with religion are understandable, and I promise at Skyline you'll experience the love of Jesus Christ, not the revenge of a Sith Lord.
Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m.
Siegel Show and Mike Friedenberg.
Well, Bob, just to kind of summarize where we are with North Korea here. North Korea's Air Force is not even a viable force anymore. Their army is, in the right situation, they could be effective, but given that they would be trying to operate with our Air Force being able to completely dominate the skies under them, they'd be being savaged by our fighters, strike fighters, by our B-52 bombers. We would take out these air defense capabilities of North Korea pretty quickly. They're not that great. They would be going up against our tanks and the South Korean tanks. We saw 30-40-1 kill ratios going against Iraqi's T-72 tanks with our M1 Abrams. Well, South Korea and the United States have, South Korea's top two tanks are comparable to the M1. We would slaughter their tanks on the battlefield. So if we take a look here, right now, what happened is Kim Jong-un knew he could not keep up with South Korea and the Western world on his conventional forces, and he went all in on getting the nuclear weapons. That's his play. Unless he gets that, he knows that he's no longer has a credible deterrent.
So you're thinking he'd like to do maybe conventional warfare to conquer South Korea and then have the threat of nuclear warfare to keep the superpowers like the United States out of it.
Well, that would be down the road. Right now he could not do it. But what he could do is if he were able to get nuclear weapons and get that threat, then things would start to open up for him. He believes that if he had that, he'd begin to be able to eventually crack the sanctions. He'd be able to get a bit of money in. He might be able to do a little modernization. But the main thing is he could then use his conventional weapons with the threat of nuclear attacks backing him up. So I think right now, not that this would be the reason to do it, but there's also humanitarian reasons. The people of North Korea are being starved to death, and it's just horrible over there. I mean, this is one of the worst places in the world to live.
This could really be a rescue of that country.
So if we were to go in and take out Kim Jong-un and his staff.
We would be a hero to the North Koreans. We would be doing
flyers and dropping, flyers everywhere about food. I mean, these soldiers in the North Korean military, in the People's Army, they have their families starving. They're starving to death over there. So I think that he's right. He's ripe for the picking. There would be some casualties, but to let him get nuclear weapons right now would just be snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. That's what I would say. So I think that there's hysteria around his capabilities. People are vastly overestimating what he could do. It's going to take losses, but nothing like we've been seeing in some of the analysis. And I will say this, if people want to take a look online and find some analysis done by the Nautilus Institute on this topic, they did a very detailed, very sober analysis that is far more realistic than you're getting from some of these other sources, these mainstream media types that don't know what they're talking about. So I'm going to just say is that it'd be nice if Kim Jong-un would agree to denuclearize and really take concrete steps to do that.
I wouldn't count on it. But
I'm not counting on that at all.
But I think it would be a mistake to let him get the nuclear weapons. And if we have to go with military options, we could do so. And the dangers of it are greatly exaggerated.
I really think Trump needs to just go into the room and say, "Now you sit down and shut up, and we'll tell you what you're going to do." That's the kind of negotiation I want to see.
So with that type of warfare addressed, we can talk about, you know, switching hats here and going toward a political mode. We've been hearing a lot about the coming blue wave, and we heard
blue
wave
meaning Democratic takeover of Congress.
I mean, the blue wave, the premise of it is that, you know, the Democrats are energized. They have this, you know, Trump's very existence.
Well,
every
they are
day.
Pretty united in their hatred of Trump.
Oh, they are.
If you want to call that being energized.
Oh, they listen. The far left in particular, and the left is energized. Okay, they are. I mean, he's their nightmare. Donald Trump is their nightmare. And so
and they just were never in a million years expecting him to win this election. They do not know how to deal with it.
Absolutely, they did not. So we are going to see a more energized Democrat Party because they're out of power. And it's pretty normal to see that. But are we going to see the blue wave that people have been talking about?
Now, before you go on, Mike, I want to remind my audience that unlike most conservative pundits, Mike came on this radio show and called the election for Trump when almost every major poll handed it to Hillary. So pay careful attention to his predictions now, because maybe he'll strike lightning twice in the same bottle.
When I made the prediction there, I had done a very thorough analysis of what was happening in Florida. And once again, getting past...
But we were hardly hearing that anywhere.
Getting past...
You were one of the few.
The media fog and the media filters on things. I literally had to go to the election centrals on these states, download the data, and do my own analysis. Literally loading it up into a database and crunching the numbers. That's what it takes to actually get good reporting. And there's so many lazy political reporters out there, you think they would do this, but nobody does it. It was very frustrating. But back to the blue wave. In Texas, there was supposed to be a blue wave. Well, what happened is that... In Texas, normally there's about a 5% Democrat turnout in a primary election, 5%. Really pretty pitiful. Republicans typically turn out about 10% in a primary. Well, this time we saw the huge change where 11% of Republicans turned out to vote and about 6.5% of Democrats turned out to vote. So percentage-wise, yeah, the Democrats had a little bit of an uptick, but Ted Cruz, you know, who was concerned, he still pulled more votes than all of the other Democrat candidates than by about 300,000 than the entire Democratic base in all the state of Texas. So, and every congressional district, the Republicans did well. And here is interesting, in one district, I think it's in the Houston area, we had a person running there by the name of Moser, and I think Fitzgerald, but basically they had a district that they thought might be vulnerable to be flipped, but they needed to get a moderate Democrat to run in the district. Well, they were hoping to get rid of Moser. Well, they couldn't get rid of her, so she's now going to be in a runoff election against the other Democrats. It's going to be nasty, savage knockdown. She could win, and she could end up with this extreme, well, she's called a progressive by the media, but extremely far-left activist could end up representing the Democrats in that district. And they're going to be dealing with that all throughout the country. They've created a monster of these left-wing activists energizing
some... Yeah, the blue dog moderate Democrats pretty much extinct, wouldn't you say?
We'll talk about that when we come back, because that's a great segue.
Okay, we'll be right back. Buying a home? Selling a home? It goes without saying that you need somebody experienced and skilled, but you also need a realtor you can trust, a man who will look out for your interests as if they were his own. This is Bob Siegel, here to steer you the right direction with just two words, Fred Valduti. Fred works with Realty Executives All Area, a company that has sold thousands of homes locally since 1994. Putting your home up for sale or selling a home can be stressful, filled with decisions you never anticipated. So put your mind at ease and call Fred Falduti. He sold my home for me at top price. Every step along the way, I benefited from his wisdom and a very generous usage of his time. By the way, Fred Falduti received the Executive of the Year Award for 2014. What? You say that was a couple of years ago? Listen, wise guy, do you want to mark the calendar or do you want somebody to sell your home for you? Whether buying or selling, the man you want is Fred Falduti with Realty Executives All Area, 619-719-7717. That's 619-719-7717 or fredfalduti.com.
The verdict is in on Bob Siegel's novel, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament. Readers love it, and they say as much in their customer reviews. Reviews such as this one. Like the Chronicles of Narnia in the last century, the story is fun and mysterious, appropriate for adults as well as kids, and should become a classic. I won't even give any spoilers, but I will say that I couldn't put it down. It makes a point without being preachy. There are twists and turns and a great ending. Like the title object, the story challenges your thinking without leaving you in despair. This book would make an excellent Christmas gift for yourself or others, and it can be enjoyed at any time of the year. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Down to our last segment. Always appreciate you being here. We'll let you finish right where we left off.
Okay. Well, we were just talking about the blue wave that did not happen in Texas, but the media coverage up to that was, you know, if you read it, you would have thought, wow, I mean, is Texas really going blue? At least, if not blue, at least purple, right? I mean, that's what I got out of it.
Isn't it true, though, that a lot of Californians are moving to Texas, even liberal ones, who can't live under liberal policies, and then when they get to Texas, these nincompoop idiotic morons try to turn Texas into the California that they had to leave.
There is some elements of that. It will be quite a ways to go before that completely happens. I hope it doesn't. But, you know, like the Austin area is quite relatively liberal. Houston, parts of Houston are. But let's go back and just say that the blue wave that was supposed to happen to Texas did not happen. Now let's talk about Pennsylvania Congressional District 18. This has been the focus of
many. This district went for Trump, didn't it?
It went by national election for Trump and by 20 points. This is a blue dog Democrat district, Bob, a classic blue dog Democrat district. There is blue dog Democrats, and they are in the traditional Rust Belt states. They went for Trump overwhelmingly. That's a district that has a 70,000 registration margin for Democrats. That they went for Trump. So we have a race now with interestingly enough, a former state, I think, Senator Rick Saccone, who's running in the race. He's a former retired Air Force intelligence officer that spent several years in North Korea. He really knows North Korea really well. He would be a great asset. Good guy, Catholic, has the endorsement of the NRA, Second Amendment, solidly pro-life. The part where he may not resonate with his district is the district has a pretty strong union presence, and he is a right-to-work guy, which means he doesn't believe in forced unionization. He does not believe that the union should be able to take your dues and use them for political purposes without your consent. So that may be an issue that he could lose some votes on. However, his opponent, it's interesting enough, has been somebody who's been dancing around the life issue, trying to pretend like he's pro-life, but he really is not. He's just come out.
Well, and he knows Trump won that district, so he's probably trying to swing both ways a little bit.
Well, the person that held the district before was a very strong pro-life Republican who, unfortunately, I mean, was very vocal about his pro-life support, who had to resign after his Twitter was released urging his mistress to get an abortion.
Oh, brother.
Okay, so that's the history of that district, okay? So now we have this guy, Connor Lamb, who is also ex-military. He's an attorney. He's 33. He's a good-looking guy. He's articulate. His family is very well-known in the district. So he's making a race out of it, and he's been very complimentary to Donald Trump. He's anti-Pelosi. He's for the tariffs. He's taken a position even a little bit to the right of Donald Trump on the Second Amendment. So this guy is not your typical Democrat running right now. He's more reminiscent of what you used to get in the past. So because he's presenting himself as a conservative Democrat, he's been able to make the race close. Now, with that said, he has come out with a lot of Weasley statements more recently about where he stands on the issue of life. He's Catholic himself. He came out with something, you know, some kind of statement.
Mumbo jumbo of as a Catholic, I'm against it, but I won't
infer
on your right.
The Catholic terminology was never pro-life. Catholics don't use the term pro-life in their religious. And
a bunch of double talk.
No
speak.
So this district has a big Catholic pro-life contingent. It is a pro-life district. So I'm going to make a prediction here based on a couple of things here. One is that pro-lifers vote in bigger numbers than do pro-choicers. They always come out, they're more reliable votes in primaries. That's just been shown over and over again. So I have a lot of friends who are Catholic and are pro-life, and nothing annoys them more than a Weasley person trying to be Catholic and pretend that they're pro-life when they're really not. So I think there's going to be a motivated pro-life vote there. The Second Amendment vote, you know, that's going to be hard to say because this Saccone,
with that school shooting, that's
yeah. They both have come out. You know, they both have stood the ground on the Second Amendment. But the tariffs and then the tax issue. The tax issue in that district is polling like 48% positive to 33% negative. So the tax issue is huge in that district. Saccone strongly supports the taxes, and they've had businesses actually hiring more people and talking about expanding business in the district. Saccone supports the Trump tax cut. Connor Lamb, the Democrat, has come out against it. So based upon Republicans generally doing better in primaries, that I think there's more reasons for people to get out and vote for Lamb, even though Connor has been trying to be sort of slimy and slippery and
so
not
this
really.
This is the primary that's coming up next?
This is going to be a special election. This is a special election. So whoever, by the way.
So it won't be a special election, meaning whoever gets it wins.
But then because the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did some gerrymandering, they'll have another election in May, and Saccone and Lamb can't even run against each other. They'll have to run again in May. It's so stupid.
That's ridiculous.
It is. So I guess my point is I am predicting a Saccone win based upon better voter turnout from the constituencies that he's going to be.
And this special election's coming right up, isn't it?
On Tuesday.
This coming Tuesday.
This Tuesday.
Okay,
yeah. So it'll be, I think it's going to be, but you can't tell
but
that from reading the
media. Then they have to do the whole thing again in the fall, you're saying.
Then in May, yeah.
In May.
Yes,
and what is the rationale behind that?
The rationale was that they managed to get a 5-2 margin on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And the 5-2 being the Democrats, they decided to gerrymander the state to try to get more Democrats in office.
You know what I like about our present judicial system? Nothing.
Yes. And that could be going. Now, I think that is working its way through the courts, and it could potentially hit the Supreme Court. Because, listen, normally you have politicians do the gerrymandering, and they do, but at least they're elected representatives. To allow unelected judges to do the gerrymandering is just an awful precedent, and I hope the Supreme Court takes it on. So on that basis, I'm going to predict PA-18 stays Republican and that the margins of victory will be greater than what the mainstream media seems to be talking
about.
Okay,
very quickly on the subject of polls, I've been hearing that Trump's doing much better in the polls sometimes, and then I'm hearing other people, usually leftist pundits, say that he isn't. What is the truth about
that?
Well,
if you look at favorability ratings, which don't necessarily translate into votes, you still have Trump running about 40-41%.
Okay, because I thought I'd heard 50% somewhere.
Well, on Rasmussen, he hit 50%.
Oh, okay. So that must.
But you also saw all the other polls coming up. Now they're kind of going back down. They may come back up, you know, based upon the North Korea thing. But he's within striking distance.
Okay.
That he could get close to 50.
We'll tune into the election on Tuesday to see if Mike was right. And Mike, we'll have you on again soon. Always great to have you. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.